A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's what Daniel wrote to us. I'm going to read this almost in full because there are about 12 layers here and each one matters. He says, do an episode on the American Logistics Standard Stack, the specific, mostly invisible rulebook that any pallet, carton, or truckload has to satisfy to move inside the United States and why it looks nothing like the rest of the world's. Cover the layers and where each one actually comes from. The 48x40 GMA pallet as the de facto national unit load, why that number and not the ISO 1200x1000, how the Grocery Manufacturers Association ended up setting a physical standard nobody legislated, and the ANSI MH1 dimensional standards that formalized it. The 53-foot trailer and the 40-foot container's awkward relationship. How 48x40 pallets stack into a 53-footer versus how badly they fit an ocean container, and why domestic and international boxes diverged. NMFC freight classes and density-based LTL pricing. How a number between 50 and 500 determines what shippers pay, who maintains the classification, and the 2025-era shift toward dimensional pricing that's been eroding the class system. Federal weight and dimension law, the 80,000-pound gross limit, the bridge formula, axle weights, and why state-by-state permitting makes legal a moving target across a single trip. The data standards, SCAC carrier codes, EDI 856 advanced ship notices, and 214 status messages, GS1 US barcodes, and SSCC pallet labels, and how much of American freight still runs on 1980s EDI rather than APIs. And retailer-imposed private standards that function as law, the routing guides, and on-time and full compliance regimes where chargebacks do the enforcement work regulators don't. He wants us to get at the tension. This is a system assembled by trade associations, retailers, and insurers rather than designed by anyone, held in place by sunk capital in racking, dock doors, and trailer fleets. Explain why it's stuck, what a clean sheet version would look like, and what it costs importers and exporters at the boundary where American standards meet everyone else's.
That's a beautiful question. It's basically asking, what if a country's entire physical economy was built on a set of decisions nobody ever voted on, and now you can't undo them without spending trillions of dollars?
And Daniel's right to frame it as a stack. Most people think about logistics one piece at a time. The truck, the pallet, the barcode. They don't see that these are layers that all have to agree with each other, and if you change one, the others break.
Let's start at the bottom, the physical layer, the pallet that everything sits on, the 48x40 GMA pallet. Where did this thing even come from?
The grocery industry, which is somehow always the answer to questions about American infrastructure.
It really is. So in the 1960s, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which is now part of the Consumer Brands Association, was trying to standardize how food moved from warehouses to supermarkets. They settled on 48 inches by 40 inches because it fit the standard supermarket aisle width, which was 48 inches. You could roll a pallet right down the aisle and stock from it. And critically, two 40-inch wide pallets placed side by side fit perfectly inside a 102-inch wide truck trailer. That's the interior width of a standard dry van, so you get two pallets across with no wasted space.
So the number wasn't pulled out of the air. It was an optimization for two specific constraints, the grocery aisle and the truck width.
And once the GMA adopted it, the entire grocery supply chain built around it. Warehouses installed racking at 48-inch widths. Forklifts were spec'd for it. Dock doors were spaced for it. The ANSI MH1 dimensional standards eventually formalized it, but that was after the fact. The government didn't design this. A trade association of food manufacturers did.
Which brings us to the awkward part. The rest of the world standardized on the ISO 1200x1000mm pallet, the Euro pallet. And these two sizes are close, but not close enough.
Right. The GMA pallet is 12 19mm by 10 16. The ISO palette is 1200 by 1000, so the American palette is 19 millimeters longer and 16 millimeters wider. That's less than an inch in both directions. But those 19 millimeters matter enormously when you're trying to fit pallets into a shipping container. A 40-foot ocean container holds 25 Euro pallets in a standard load pattern. It holds only 20 or 21 GMA pallets. That's a 15 to 20% space penalty at the port.
So the American pallet is optimized for domestic trucking and terrible for international shipping.
And that's not an accident. It's the result of two systems optimizing for different things. The ISO pallet was designed for European shipping containers and rail cars. The GMA pallet was designed for American grocery trucks. Neither side was wrong. They just weren't talking to each other.
The 53-foot trailer is where this divergence really locks in.
Oh, this is my favorite part. A 53-foot trailer holds 26 GMA pallets in a standard 2-pallet-wide pattern. It's a perfect fit. 26 pallets, no wasted inches. But the 53-foot trailer only exists because of a specific American regulatory quirk. In 1982, the Surface Transportation Assistance Act set the national truck length limit at 48 feet for trailers. But states could allow longer trailers on their own roads, and many did. Carriers pushed for longer trailers because more pallets per trip means lower cost per pallet. Eventually, the 53-foot trailer became the de facto standard, and in 2015, the federal government essentially recognized it by requiring that any trailer length restriction on the national network couldn't be less than 53 feet.
Wait, so for decades, the standard American trailer was technically illegal under federal law, but legal under state law?
On certain roads, yes. The national network, which is the designated system of interstates and major highways, allowed longer trailers under state permits. Carriers operated 53-footers under what were called grandfather rights in many states. The law caught up to reality eventually, but the reality was built first.
That's the whole story of American logistics standards in one sentence. The reality was built first, and the law caught up eventually.
And here's the key mismatch. Ocean containers are 40 feet or 20 feet long. The 40-foot container is the global standard because it's what fits on ships, on cranes, on rail cars, everywhere from Shanghai to Rotterdam. But the 48x40 GMA pallet's 40-inch dimension doesn't divide evenly into the interior length of a 40-foot container. You get about 20 pallets in there with some awkward gaps. Meanwhile, that same pallet loads perfectly into a 53-foot domestic trailer.
So, American logistics optimized for moving goods between American warehouses, and the rest of the world optimized for moving goods between continents.
And now, we're stuck. Warehouses have racking designed for 48x40 pallets. Trailer fleets are built around 53-foot lengths. Dock doors are spaced for these dimensions. Automated material handling equipment, conveyor systems, robotic palletizers, automated storage and retrieval systems, all built for the GMA footprint. Switching to ISO pallets would require replacing billions of dollars in physical infrastructure. Nobody wants to be the first to spend that money.
The sunk capital trap. You built a cathedral and now you can't move the walls.
And it's not just the pallets. Let's move up a layer, how we price all this freight. The NMFC system.
The National Motor Freight Classification, which assigns every conceivable product a number between 50 and 500.
Maintained by the National Motor Freight Traffic Association, the NMFTA. The class number determines the shipping rate. Class 50 is dense stuff, steel beams, bricks, things that are heavy for their size. Class 500 is the opposite. Ping pong balls, foam packaging, things that take up a lot of space but weigh nothing. The logic is that light, bulky freight costs the carrier more per pound to move because it fills the trailer before it hits the weight limit.
So you're paying for the space you occupy, not just the weight.
Four factors determine the class. Density is the biggest, pounds per cubic foot. Then stowability. Can you stack things on top of it, or is it hazardous or oddly shaped? Then handling. Does it require special equipment or care? And finally, liability. Is it fragile, perishable, or valuable? The NMFTA publishes a massive book, the NMFC, that lists class assignments for thousands of commodities. And shippers and carriers have been arguing over these classifications for decades.
Arguing how?
Well, if you're a shipper, you want your product in a lower class because you pay less. If you're a carrier, you want it in a higher class because you earn more. So there's a whole industry of freight classification consultants who help shippers get their products reclassified. You submit samples to the NMFTA, they test the density and handling characteristics, and they issue a ruling. It's a slow, bureaucratic process that runs on paper and physical samples in a lot of cases.
Which sounds like a system ripe for disruption.
And that's exactly what's happening. The 2025 era shift is dimensional pricing, dim weight pricing. The carriers are basically saying, we don't need a committee to tell us how much space your freight takes up, we'll just measure it. Length times width times height divided by a dimensional factor gives you a billable weight. If your actual weight is higher, you pay on actual weight. If your dimensional weight is higher, you pay on that. It's already standard in parcel shipping. UPS and FedEx have been doing it for years. Now it's moving into LTL.
LTL being less than truckload.
Right, shipments that don't fill a whole trailer. FedEx Freight and XPO, two of the biggest LTL carriers, have been aggressively moving toward density-based pricing that effectively bypasses the NMFC class for many shipments. They're not abolishing the class system, yet, but they're making it less relevant. The carrier just wants to know how much space you're taking up and how much you weigh. Everything else is secondary.
So, the NMFTA's elaborate classification system is being slowly undermined by a tape measure and a scale.
That's the direction. But the class system won't die overnight because it's embedded in contracts, in rate tariffs filed with the government, in the software that thousands of shippers and brokers use. The switching costs are enormous, just like with the pallets.
Which brings us to the legal layer. The 80,000-pound gorilla.
The federal gross vehicle weight limit, 80,000 pounds for a 5-axle tractor trailer on the interstate system. That's been the law since 1982. Before that, it was 73,280 pounds, which is a wonderfully specific number. The 80,000-pound limit breaks down into axle limits. 20,000 pounds on a single axle, 34,000 pounds on a tandem axle group. And then there's the bridge formula.
The bridge formula. Explain this.
It's a mathematical formula that limits the weight on any group of axles based on the distance between them. The idea is to protect bridges from excessive stress. If your axles are close together, the weight is concentrated on a smaller section of the bridge, so you're allowed less total weight on that group. If you spread the axles farther apart, you can carry more weight on that group because the load is distributed. It's actually a beautiful piece of civil engineering. It translates the physical stress on a bridge structure into a simple formula that a truck-scale operator can apply.
But then the states get involved.
And this is where legal becomes a moving target. The federal limits apply on the interstate system, but states can set their own limits on state roads. Some states allow heavier weights, 90,000 pounds or more on certain routes. Some have different axle configurations that are legal in one state but not another. A truck carrying 44,000 pounds of freight from Los Angeles to Dallas might need permits for California's interpretation of the bridge formula, Arizona's different axle spacing rules, and Texas's specific weight limits on certain highways. One trip, three different legal regimes.
So a truck that's perfectly legal in California can become illegal the moment it crosses into Arizona.
Unless the carrier has obtained permits in advance for each state, which they do. There's an entire industry of permit services that handle this. But it means that the legal weight of a truck isn't a single number, it's a function of where the truck is at that exact moment.
And now the data layer. The part nobody sees but everything depends on.
Let's start with SCAC codes. Standard Carrier Alpha Codes, four-letter identifiers assigned by the NMFTA. Every carrier that wants to do business in the U.S. freight system needs one. It's how systems identify who's moving the freight. If you're a carrier and you don't have a SAC code, you essentially don't exist to the electronic infrastructure.
Four letters that function as a passport.
Then there's EDI, Electronic Data Interchange. Specifically, EDI 856, the Advanced Ship Notice, and EDI 214, the Transportation Carrier Status Message. The 856 is sent from the shipper to the receiver before the shipment arrives. It says exactly what's in the shipment, item by item, carton by carton, pallet by pallet, so the receiver's warehouse management system knows what's coming and can plan put away. The 214 is the carrier status update, where the truck is, whether it's on time, if there's a delay.
And this all runs on a protocol designed in the 1980s.
The ANSI X12 standard. It's not pretty. It's not modern. It's fixed width fields and segment terminators and functional acknowledgement messages that confirm receipt of other messages. But it works. It's reliable. It's standardized. And it's deeply embedded in the ERP systems, the Enterprise Resource Planning software, that runs every major manufacturer and retailer in the country. Replacing EDI with modern APIs would require rewriting those integrations, retraining staff, and coordinating thousands of trading partners to switch at the same time.
The coordination problem again?
APIs are growing. The logistics industry is slowly modernizing, but EDI still carries the vast majority of U.S. freight transactions. The switching costs are simply too high for any single company to bear alone.
Then the barcodes on top of that.
GS1 US manages the barcode standards. The SSCC, Serial Shipping Container Code, is the standard for pallet labels. It's an 18-digit number encoded in a GS1 128 barcode that uniquely identifies every pallet in the supply chain. Scan it, and you know what's on the pallet, where it came from, where it's going, when it was packed, and what's in each carton. The SSCC is the key that unlocks all the EDI messages. The 856 references, the SSCC, the 214 references, the SSCC, the warehouse management system tracks the SSCC.
The barcode on the pallet is the physical token that ties the physical world to the data world.
If that barcode is damaged, missing, or unreadable, the pallet becomes invisible. It's still physically there, but the system doesn't know it exists. That's a chargeback waiting to happen.
Which brings us to the top layer. The retailers.
The private standards that function as law. Every major retailer, Walmart, Target, Home Depot, Amazon, has a routing guide. It's a document that tells suppliers exactly how to ship to them, which carriers are approved, which pallet types are acceptable, and if you show up with a Euro pallet at a Walmart distribution center, you're getting rejected, which labeling standards must be followed, which delivery windows are available, and you book a specific appointment, not a general window.
If you don't comply?
Chargebacks. Walmart's on-time, in-full requirements. OTIF are the most famous example. The shipment must arrive within a one-day delivery window. It must be at least 98% complete, meaning no more than 2% of the order quantity is missing or damaged. If you miss either metric, Walmart issues a chargeback. It can be up to 3% of the shipment value. That's not a late fee. That's a penalty, and it's enforced through the contract, not through any government regulation.
Walmart is effectively a private regulator of American logistics.
They're more rigid than most government regulators. A government regulation might give you a warning, a grace period, an appeals process. Walmart's routing guide gives you a chargeback. If you want to sell to the largest retailer in America, you comply. That's the entire enforcement mechanism, access to market.
Every major retailer has their own version of this.
Each with different carriers, different labeling requirements, different delivery windows, different chargeback formulas. If you're a supplier selling to 5 different retailers, you're complying with 5 different private regulatory regimes. And none of them are interoperable. You can't use Target's routing guide to ship to Home Depot.
We've got physical standards set by a grocery trade association, pricing classifications maintained by a motor freight association, weight limits set by federal law, but interpreted differently by every state, data standards running on 1980s infrastructure, and private enforcement regimes run by retailers. And none of these layers were designed together.
That's the system. Assembled, not designed. Each layer made sense when it was created. The GMA pallet solved a real problem for grocery distribution in the 60s. The 53-foot trailer solved a real problem for carrier economics. The NMFC solved a real problem for pricing freight that varied wildly in density. EDI solved a real problem for automating purchase orders and shipping notices. Walmart's routing guide solved a real problem for managing inbound freight at scale.
But nobody ever asked, what happens when all these solutions have to work together?
The answer is friction, especially at the boundary where American standards meet the rest of the world's.
Let's talk about that boundary. What does it actually cost?
Take a European exporter shipping to Walmart. They have to use GMA pallets, not Euro pallets. So they either maintain a separate pallet pool just for U.S. shipments, or they pay to transfer their goods onto GMA pallets at a U.S. warehouse. They have to comply with Walmart's routing guide, which specifies approved U.S. carriers, not international ones. they have to send EDI 856 messages with specific GS1128 barcodes in a format that their European ERP system probably doesn't generate natively. They have to accept OTIF chargebacks. And on top of all that, they're paying the ocean container space penalty, 15 to 20% more container space for the same cargo because GMA pallets don't pack efficiently into ISO containers.
They're paying a friction tax at every layer.
The logistics industry estimates this friction tax at 5 to 10% of total logistics costs for cross-border shipments into the U.S. That's not a small number. On a container of goods worth $100,000, you might be spending an extra $5,000 to $10,000 just to navigate the standards mismatch.
The clean sheet version. If we could wave a wand.
A single pallet size compatible with both domestic trucks and ocean containers. Probably the ISO 1200 by 1000 or some new hybrid. Standardized dimensional pricing across all modes, no more NMFC class arguments. API-based data exchange replacing EDI with real-time visibility instead of batch EDI transmissions. Uniform federal weight limits with no state-by-state variation or at least a single national permit system. And a single set of retailer compliance standards instead of every retailer having their own routing guide.
Which would cost trillions and take years.
Decades, probably. The physical infrastructure alone, every warehouse rack, every dock door, every trailer, every automated system, would need to be replaced or retrofitted. The software transition from EDI to APIs would require every trading partner in every supply chain to switch simultaneously. And the retailer routing guides? Well, Walmart isn't going to give up control of its inbound supply chain because it'd be more efficient for the system as a whole. They've optimized for themselves.
The system is stuck not because anyone's stupid or malicious, but because everyone optimized locally, and now we're all locked into each other's optimizations.
Path dependence. The decisions made in the 1960s by grocery manufacturers, in the 80s by trucking companies and EDI standards bodies, in the 90s and 2000s by retailers building their compliance regimes, each one narrowed the set of possible futures. Now we're in a very narrow corridor, and the cost of widening it's borne by whoever moves first.
Which means nobody moves.
Which means the system stays frozen, maybe for another 50 years.
What do we do with this knowledge? For the logistics professionals listening, the system isn't rational, it's historical. Don't wait for it to change. Invest in systems that handle the current complexity. Build expertise in NMFC classification, in EDI integration, in retailer compliance. These are moats, not bugs.
For importers and exporters, budget for the friction tax. It's real and it's not going away. Plan for pallet incompatibility. Budget for EDI implementation if you don't have it. Read the routing guides before you sign the contract. The cost of non-compliance, chargebacks, rejected shipments, lost shelf space, far exceeds the cost of compliance.
For technology providers, the opportunity isn't in replacing the legacy systems. It's in bridging them. The dimensional pricing shift is creating demand for better density calculation tools, better rate shopping platforms, better visibility into where freight is and what it's costing. The EDI to API transition is happening slowly, and the winners will be the companies that make both work together, not the ones that try to kill EDI.
The carriers moving to dimensional pricing are essentially saying, we don't want to argue about classification anymore. We just want to measure the box and charge for the space. That creates a need for tools that help shippers predict their dimensional weight costs before they ship, optimize their packaging, and choose the right carrier for each shipment. That's a real business opportunity right now.
That leaves us with some open questions. Will the dimensional pricing shift eventually kill the NMFC class system entirely? It's eroding it, but the class system is embedded in contracts and tariffs that will take years to unwind. Will the push for sustainability, reducing container space waste, optimizing loads, force a pallet standard change? 15 to 20% wasted container space is hard to defend when everyone's tracking carbon emissions. Or will the sunk capital trap keep the system frozen for another 50 years?
My bet is on frozen. The coordination problem is just too big, but the pressure is building. E-commerce and omnichannel distribution are growing. More shipments, smaller shipments, faster shipments. The legacy standard stack was built for a world of full pallets moving from factory to distribution center. It's straining under the weight of e-commerce, where you're shipping individual items to individual consumers. The 2025 era changes in dimensional pricing are just the beginning of that strain showing.
If this episode made you think differently about the pallets in your warehouse, or the barcode on them, or the trailer they ride in, or the chargeback you got last week, share it with someone in logistics, and send your weird prompts to show at myweirdprompts.com. We might just do an episode on them.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.